This episode of See Here is dedicated in memory of William Smith. Long may he reign, father of Conan.
Episode 87 of the See Here podcast. We're proudly part of the Pantheon Network. Morris speaking here in Melbourne. Over in Bath is my good friend and compadre, Mr. Bernard Stickwell.
Hello.
And over in Brantford, Ontario is Mr. Tim Merrill.
Oi, hoi.
Welcome to this month's episode. And before I talk about what it is that we're going to be talking about for this month's show, I want to give a huge thanks out to our good friends, Mike White and Skiz Sizek, for filling in all of our shoes for last month for episode 86 when they were talking about the Sparks documentary, The Sparks Brothers. We've never had a show where none of us showed up. Imagine a war and no one came. That's exactly what happened here on our podcast. So huge thanks to Mike and Skiz for doing that. This month, however, we have an interview that we've just finished with documentarian Scott Crawford. Some of you may have seen his previous film, Salad Days, about the DC punk scene. Well, he put out another documentary last year about Cream magazine.
Boy, howdy.
I had never read the magazine. Wasn't available here, at least to the best of my knowledge. So watching this documentary was a real eye-opener for me. We had a fascinating conversation with him. Hope you enjoy it. We'll be back in a moment. What we're going to do is play the trailer for the film, and then we'll come back with our conversation with Scott, and then we'll be back at the end of that to talk about next month on See Here for episode 88. You're listening to See Here.
Cream magazine was our Facebook. It was our social media.
I lived by what was printed in Cream magazine.
It was a rock magazine with a capital R.
Most people want to fit in somewhere. I wasn't going to find them in my high school. I found them in Cream magazine.
Buying Cream was a little bit like buying Playboy. You didn't want your parents to see either one of them.
None of them had any business running, editing, or writing for a rock magazine.
We're going to introduce everybody.
Hi, what's happening?
What are you doing here?
I sell dope downstairs.
Oh, no.
Barry always had an explosive temper.
Got a newspaper to get out?
I had no credentials at all.
We were this team of people who were all a little off.
To put it in like a band comparison, that's when the band happened.
Cream magazine being based in Detroit gave it the grit.
If you live in the Midwest, it's not all laid back and peace and love and good vibes.
In 1971, the Rolling Stone party line was that the next big thing was James Taylor. Many teenagers went to Cream to learn about noisier stuff.
Lester Bangs and I started the same day.
He kind of liked going against the grain. What's popular? You guys suck.
Take Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. Here is, like, musical sterility at its pinnacle.
There's no parallel for it in the rest of rock journalism. It was not a magazine that was about rock and roll. Rock and roll was taking place at the magazine.
Everybody was politically incorrect. That's what made Cream so good. He told the truth.
50 years after Cream's first issue published, it still stands for something. Either you're in on the joke or you are the joke.
America's only rock and roll magazine. Yeah.
Welcome back to episode 87 of See Here podcast, and Bernie, Tim, and I are thrilled that we have on a Zoom connection, the director of this month's focused film, Scott Crawford, the director of Cream, America's only rock and roll magazine. Welcome to See Here, Scott.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's our honor to have you onto the show. Congratulations on the release of the film. So this actually came out, what, in 2019 or was it 2020?
Let's see, it would have been last summer. So about, well, actually not even quite a year ago. So last August, September-ish, maybe the last week of August. Unfortunately, it was going to be, you know, we had a lot of theatrical plans for it, but due to the pandemic, they all kind of went down the toilet. But yeah, it did come out on Amazon and Netflix and everything else. It's been about a year ago.
Okay. I wanted to start off, you've been actually running a couple of music magazines yourself over the last 20 years, Harp and then Blurt. And you're also a podcaster. You've also got your own show called Spoke. Well, as a film director and as a podcaster and as a magazine editor, how do you work out what medium is best for a story that you particularly want to pursue? With the Cream doc, you felt that warranted like the full documentary treatment, but with so much that you obviously cover through all those mediums, is there anything that you sort of think, yeah, I think that this story would be best be told in this particular medium?
Yeah, that's a great question. I really think in the case of Cream and Salad Days, the first film that I did, the music is such a part of that story that you need to hear it. You need to hear that music and literally feel it. So to me, I felt like the documentary format was really best to tell those stories. Obviously, there's a million more stories you can tell about both Cream and, you know, the DC punk scene, but that was the way that I felt like it would make the biggest impact. And with Cream, again, such a story about a time and a place, and the music really helps capture that.
Could Cream have only come out when it did, like the late 60s? It just sort of seems interesting to me that, you know, only 5 years prior, you know, I'm always reading a ton of Beatles-related books or watching Beatles-related documentaries. And it seems like, you know, the early 60s in England, I mean, they had NME and Melody Maker, which I believe were mostly at that time either about professional musicians searching for other professional musicians, or it was blues and jazz analysis. And the only other sort of journalism or print that was dedicated to music reporting was more about what's Paul McCartney's favorite drink? What sort of films does John Lennon like to watch? It was all trivial. It wasn't going into the music like the way how we know it so much. It's ubiquitous nowadays. So could Cream have only come out once those kids had actually sort of grown up and said, we want to pursue this. We're tired of all the trivia. We're old enough to actually be writing. The world has changed. There's America and Vietnam conflict. The world is a different place. What changed? Could Cream have only come out when it did?
You got to remember, first of all, as you said, rock and roll journalism was not really a thing. It hadn't really been created yet. I mean, jazz and blues were the only serious critical sort of journalism at that point. You had a magazine called Crawdaddy that was really the first one explore rock and roll in any kind of, you know, meaningful or sort of somewhat intellectual kind of way. But I think that with Rolling Stone coming out when it did, I think it was only natural for another magazine to come out and kind of be another voice. And these people were really smart people. I mean, you know, talking 68, 69 in Detroit, there was so much culturally happening. I mean, if you look at it, I mean, just look at the films from that period too. I mean, the films are a reflection of what was going on, you know, in society at that point. And I think it was only natural that there'd be magazines that would reflect that as well. Cream really started out, we didn't touch on it that much in the film, but it really was a very political magazine at first, more so than maybe even Rolling Stone. I mean, there was a whole part of the film that we ended up not using about a lot of the staff members were actually part of the White Panthers, which were the sort of hippie equivalent to the Black Panthers.
I was going
to
say, was Sinclair was involved with the early beginnings,
right,
of Cream magazine?
John Sinclair, very early stages of Cream, and moved out of Detroit and into the suburb. I forgot the name of the, I'm drawing a blank. Anyway, outside of Detroit a little bit. But yeah, so I do think that it was a natural sort of extension of what was going on culturally. And, you know, Cream really, for those not familiar, just to put it quickly, Cream was really like the anti-Rolling Stone. It was the bratty, snotty.
Rolling Stone was kind of almost like university for the intellectuals and the ponytails and the chinwaggers, whereas Cream was like Delta House on secret probation, super secret probation. You know what I mean?
I didn't grow up with with Cream. I'm not even sure whether the magazine was imported here, and I was probably too young at the time to have read it, even if it was easily available. So I've had to rely like on looking on Rock's back pages for articles. And I'm sure though that the whole magazine experience is more than just reading separate articles. But the articles that I did see from people like Dave Marsh, who I've long been an admirer of as a writer, Lester Bangs, seemed to me as serious and as in-depth as anything that you imagine coming from out of Wenner's version of Rolling Stone magazine. So was it a cross between we're going to take maybe the in-depth writing of Rolling Stone of that period and mix it with Mad magazine? I'm hearing the contrast, but I'm not sort of fully getting it from this perspective.
Certainly, both Marsh and Lester were as smart, if not smarter, than a lot of the writers at Rolling Stone. But, you know, they weren't Ivy League educated guys. They were working class. Well, Lester's from California, but Dave was a real, you know, his parents were working class and he was a working class kid. And man, one of the smartest men I've ever spoken to. And if you look at his early writing, it's just like incredible to read something from a kid who's 18, 19 years old. You can't believe he's saying the stuff he's saying. I'm sorry, I think I might have forgotten your question.
Just about the legitimacy of Cream compared to Rolling Stone, where Rolling Stone was considered the more quote unquote intellectual entity.
Oh, I see.
Whereas Cream was more the fast, the loose, you know, street level. Knowledge, right?
I think, yes, and you're right. And I think what you're trying to ask is like, where, yes, Cream was like the brattier version, but it was no less intelligent.
Right. Absolutely.
Were as smart, if not smarter than Jan Wenner. They weren't beholden to advertisers like Jan Wenner was. You know, there was a lot of pay to play going on, right, and stuff like that.
So you mentioned in the film as well that Jan Wenner was one of the people you spoke to in the film mentions that Jan Wenner was almost kind of blinded by the idea of celebrity as well. So maybe his approach and his writer's approach was certainly more biased to be more maybe puff pieces than it was actual creditable writing and journalism.
Right.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Jan was known for, I mean, this is a well-known fact that the writers, they do like a rating system, you know, it's like A, B, C, D, or no, I'm sorry, it's 4 stars or 5 stars, right? Okay. So if a writer wrote a 5-star review of a record that didn't, for a band whose record company refused to advertise that issue, Jan would take that 5-star review and make it a 2-star review. I mean, it was just part of working there. Conversely,
he sounds like a businessman than a creator.
That was even before the whole pay to play thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, payola and all that shit. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it was a form of that, and you know, I think even to this day, it probably still continues there. But that's just kind of his editorial approach. But that to me is not really real. That's suspect journalism.
You know? Well, what's really funny too is like there's the people that are just flat out blunt. Like, for example, I love the bit in the film talking about Lester and when Alice Cooper talks about his review of their first album.
We finally got an album out. Lester Bangs reviewed it as a tragic waste of plastic, which we all doubled up laughing over. He said, that's a great review.
And Cooper's just like, we're all laughing, thinking it's hilarious. And Lester's just completely trashing the album, just saying it's a waste of plastic. And I just thought that was great because Cooper got it. The writing was Cream for me, a lot of the reviews and shit. It was almost like where when I was a kid and I used to go to the record store, there'd be that guy behind the counter and he'd be playing something really fucking hot. And you'd go up and go, what is this? And he'd be like, this is not for you.
Yeah.
This is not for you. No. You wouldn't appreciate it. You know, and I think a lot of the writing in Cream, it wasn't that they were pompous and it wasn't that they were playing this attitude, but it was this whole kind of thing where this is pure unadulterated rock and you better be ready for it. They told you exactly what it was.
Yeah. And these were, you know, and it wasn't just trashing it for the sake of trashing. Maybe they did occasionally, but these are people that really, really love the music. And, you know, in the case of like a Dave Marsh, you know, were willing to fight, like literally fight over the merits of a particular album because they cared so much about the music. I challenge anyone to find that right now in a newsroom somewhere. But to that point, it was like, it was, you know, life and death.
Right. And there was also that funny bit with Lester. It makes me laugh when you do the interview with the Splooge where he's talking about saying, oh, well, I think Lester liked other people better than me because he smoked dope with them and I don't smoke dope. You know, it's just like, give me a break, dude.
Yeah. No, it had nothing to do with that, Nuge.
Exactly. I got to make a confession about Cream magazine. Cream got me in a lot of shit in public school because I actually brought an issue of Cream to public school, and it had something to do with shaving cream, or maybe it was whipped cream, and maybe it was a certain lady named Wendy O. Williams.
You sure it wasn't your Herb Alpert album, Tim?
No, it was my Herb Alpert album. I got dragged to the principal's office, and basically the teacher pulled it out of my hands, gave it to the principal, and the principal said, "What are you bringing this to school for? You ain't having it."
It was probably worth it, though, right?
I mean, oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It was a holy grail. I mean, it was just like, I love the bit where Jeff Daniels, when you're interviewing him, when he actually says it was like the 13-year-old's equivalent of Playboy.
It really was.
It really was.
Yeah. Even me. I mean, when I younger than I'm a younger generation from obviously most of the staffers, but I went and bought ton. There was a used bookstore close to me when I was a kid. And I was also a fanzine kid. So I discovered like punk rock fanzines first with Cream. Knew enough to go, oh, Cream. Okay. This is where all this started. And So I bought like just like a stack of this high of Creams and had them in my bedroom. And I always was like hiding, like, I don't think I'm supposed to, you know, and just like in the film, there was nudity sometimes. And it was the least politically correct magazine in terms of music that there was. It was like Mad Magazine.
But it was subversive, wasn't it? Subversive word.
Totally.
By design.
Two things that really were my entry points to punk rock. One was Don Kirshner's rock concert, Seeing Suicide, on there. And it was Cream.
Yeah.
Because Cream was the first magazine where I actually got wind of the Cramps, Johnny Thunders, and the Heartbreakers. This was before MRR. This was before I discovered Maximum Rock and Roll and fanzines and all of that. It was just, and this was even when Blondie was considered punk. I mean, when the Talking Heads were considered punk, all of that.
Yeah, they were the only ones that were writing about that stuff, at least in any kind of real meaningful way, and especially on the newsstands, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were number two at one point in the 70s. They were number two to Rolling Stone in circulation numbers. We're talking about a magazine, you know, that's, you know, over 100,000 circulation, and to take a chance on a band like the Cramps or the Ramones, or, you know, we're not getting any radio airplay whatsoever. Perubu, all this punk rock stuff that was happening, you know, no one else was writing about it. Certainly
no.
Earlier on, I asked you about whether 68-69 was the only time that Cream could have come out. Am I reading right that your film also says that this magazine couldn't have come out of anywhere but Detroit, because at that period it was very political, there was a lot of violence, there were all these great acts that were coming out of Detroit at that time, or through that whole decade. So have I read that right? You're also saying that, you know, really that Cream was the perfect magazine for Detroit. It couldn't have come out of Los Angeles or New York.
Well, that was certainly the case I was making, yeah. I mean, I just think that everything came together. It all worked hand in hand. The fact that you had the music that was coming out of Detroit at that time was such a reflection of the times, and, you know, whether it was proto-punk stuff like MC5, or, you know, go even earlier with Motown. I mean, there was so much stuff going on in Detroit, and it was just such a reflection of what was going on, and all of that energy. It was just this, you know, it was just one of those periods, and, you know, it was just this white hot time, and it, you know, it had to be documented somehow. And it was, like I said, it was only natural that it would come from a place like Detroit.
I gave Cleveland with a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because Freed coined the phrase in Cleveland. But as far as I'm concerned, you know, the only reason it's not in Detroit is because you're never going to hear anybody say, "Hey, honey, put the kids in the car. We're driving to Detroit."
Yeah.
You know, it's just, but because to me, Detroit, that's the rock and roll city for me in the United States, period. It's like, that's it, man. Like, there's no.
I'm with you. I think even more, I think in some ways, even more than, more so than New York City.
Oh, yeah.
And arguably LA. I mean, LA was different. It was just a different thing, but
right.
Detroit had a very specific thing that it can lay claim to.
Both New York and LA have what were considered vintage punk rock periods, you know, the 70s for New York and the early 80s for Los Angeles. But mm-hmm. with proto-punk, it certainly sounds, as you're saying, with the MC5 and the early sounds of Alice Cooper.
Stooges, and Sonic Rendezvous Band, like all that shit.
And one of my favorite bootlegs is one that was based on the Nuggets set called Michigan Nuggets. And there's a ton of great acts on that, you know, stuff which was, if not for that bootleg, it would have been all lost to the mist of time, but all very tough sounding acts, you know, Bob Seger before became exactly. pop in the 70s.
One thing I love in the film is when you're talking to Brother Wayne, when he's actually saying back in the day, all the rock acts would actually go and see the Motown acts.
Yeah, I love
and then
that.
The Motown acts would actually go and see all the rock acts. And I think that's a definitive part to me of what really is one of the key elements of what was going on with music in Detroit at the time was the whole blending of race and the blending of music, and that nobody really looked at one as being greater than the other. And I mean, as much as there was all the racial divide on the street, when it came to the clubs and it came to the music, everybody saw everything as one and the same, you know? I was going to say, and there's also that bit that I love. And to me, it's like this last week, it was the 50th year that MC5's High Time just came out. And when you actually hear that track Skunk, sonically speaking, when Sun Ra's orchestra, they got it together with the MC5.
Yeah, I mean, Kramer's a huge Coltrane. That whole band was, you know, really big into a lot of that. You know, Wayne Kramer to this day, you know, talks about what a big influence Coltrane was. And so it would only make sense to have Sun Ra and those guys all come together.
Pharoah Saunders, all those guys. Yeah.
But it's funny you brought that part up because I could relate to that because there's in Saladay's, there was two kinds of music that were going on in DC.
Go-go.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so the punks would go see the go-go shows, and a lot of the go-go guys would come to the punk rock shows. It was more like punk rock kids going to see go-go because it was just like, it was so much fun. You couldn't not dance, even if you're like the dorky white guy like me. It was like, you know, you just couldn't stand still. I felt like there was a nice little thread there. Again, it's these two cities that are not on the coasts. They had to create something that's entirely their own,
right?
And they have this music that's kind of indigenous just to their city or a sound or an aesthetic. And so that's one of the things that I felt like there were a lot of parallels for both films. And I thought
absolutely. And with Cream, with the magazine in itself, it was like a plot where it was just kind of like, you got something to throw in, throw it.
Yeah.
Do it.
Yeah. There was no rules in terms of like, you couldn't review, oh, that's not rock and roll. Okay. Well, you know, no, you'd see a McCoy Tyner record or something next to a Sonny Chirac and then Throbbing Gristle. I mean, it would all be in one, and then Aerosmith, it would all be in one issue. I love the editorial freedom there. I think that stopped maybe, or it didn't stop, but I think it, as the 80s went on and publishers changed, I think some of that wasn't quite the same, but initially that was there.
Well, through the 80s, Cream just sort of became a brand, didn't it? I mean, like once there was no Lester, once there was no Dave Marsh, once there was no Barry Kramer, other interests came out and bought the magazine out. I mean, this is based on what I read, because you only sort of covered just a little bit at the end of your film about what happened post the classic era of Cream.
That was on purpose. The way I kind of look at it, and I think even Cameron Crowe might even say it in the film, but I kind of saw those three guys as like, that was like the band. And when the band broke up, then it was like, what was left? It was still a great, you know, magazine in a lot of ways, but it wasn't,
one of those bands that tore with no original members.
Tribute acts. Yeah.
It would be like Led Zeppelin with like the original bass player that tried out, you know, before, you know, I don't know, you know, I'm just trying to come up with a metaphor and it's not working. But anyway, you know what I'm saying? They moved to LA and became like, there was a lot of hair metal stuff. Of course, the writers that, you know, had to cover it, you know, the emphasis is had to cover that stuff because the publisher at that point was telling them they had to, as opposed to years before. You know, they hated that stuff. You could see that they hated it, you know, in the writing. One of the writers told me there's a cover of Cream. I'm not sure which issue. I have to find it, but it has Motley Crue on the cover. It's all the headlines on the front cover are actually all Robin Hitchcock song titles. I mean, they hated that shit. You know, they hated the music. Yeah. So they had to find ways to like subtly still entertain themselves. Right.
I I could be wrong, but I think at the very, very end, Cream morphed into a magazine that was all about music videos. There was a magazine that was focusing on MTV music videos or videos in general, and I think video games too, that it went from Cream into video games, and then there was another one about music videos or something like that. But
that's probably right, because they did branch out and do a number of different magazines at one point. The video game magazine was one of them. I believe it was Videodrome.
I forget the name of it now.
Yeah,
exactly.
I used to buy it as a kid, and I didn't know when I was doing research for the film. I went, oh my God, those guys did that? So,
yeah.
So there was a period of time where they were doing like three magazines a month, literally, and just cranking them out.
Almost inevitably in the 70s, humor meant a certain amount of sexist rhetoric and jokes.
I wanted to ask something about one particular person who shows up in the film who I know of through his website, but had no idea that he was a writer for Cream, and that's Robert Christgau.
Oh.
Christgau, I'll be polite, is someone who frustrates me through the articles that he's written or his rating system, and it always seemed to me like, oh, this is going to be liked right. I'm going to shitbag this album, and I've spoken to a few other people who said, yeah, that's the sort of guy who he was. But was that what he was doing back in the day of Cream, and did he just sort of think, right, I've got this persona, I'm going to run with it? What was Robert Christgau's role, you know, when he was writing for Cream?
Well, he had his own column. What was it called? Christgau's Record Guide or something like that. So I think he took up about four pages, or maybe it was two spreads, I think. And yeah, I mean, he was right in there with the best of Cream. I mean, he could eviscerate you if he wanted to. But again, you know, these are really smart people, a real gift. So again, even if he's destroying, or even if you hate what he's saying, it's still being said in a way that no one else is saying at that point, you know. And he can be frustrating. They could all be frustrating. And they, you know, even Lester was annoying sometimes.
I was going to say, for Lester, I got a feeling with Lester Bangs, he was a little bit, to me, almost like Andy Kaufman.
Yeah.
Where you couldn't tell if he was taking the piss with you or he was dead serious, you know.
No, I agree. I made a point of showing in the film too, where, you know, he was like, rock stars are not our friends. It's our job to take them down a few pegs, which they did. Right. But on the other hand, if he got invited to a party with a bunch of rock stars, go to the party and hang out with the rock stars. I mean, he loved being a celebrity just as much as he making fun of other celebrities. So, I mean, he was really larger than life. I mean, there aren't that many writers really that I can think of other than maybe like Hunter S. Thompson or something like that, where their celebrity was almost on par with the people they were interviewing.
Did Hunter S. Thompson ever write for Cream?
No, never did. But Bukowski did.
Right. Yes, I saw in your film where you're showing some snapshots of magazine covers. Yes, I did see that.
Nick Tasches, Richard Meltzer, I mean, you name it. But Hunter S. Thompson, I think Hunter had an exclusive with Jan Wenner. I'm pretty sure Jan would pay him a shit ton of money to write for him. And I think he kind of owned him, I think, in terms of the music world.
I think Hunter owed him so much on tabs and everything that he ran up. It was just kind of, you're an exclusive to us, man, because you owe me.
Yeah, I know for one article, this was in the 70s, he paid Hunter $25,000 to write it. This is in the 70s. So,
wow.
You know, so I think there was probably a sort of proprietary kind of thing there. I could be wrong, but no, Hunter never, although, you know, you'd think he should have written for him and write up his album, but knowing Cream, he probably wanted too much money and they were like, you know, fuck you.
Another writer who I could really see, based on what I'm understanding now about how Cream worked, someone like Kinky Friedman, I think he would have been someone who would have been great. I don't know, did he ever write for Cream?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I'm going to look that up, though, actually.
He seems like a good fit.
Yeah. Yeah. I met Kinky Guy like maybe 10 years ago or something. Yeah. If he didn't write for Cream, I'd actually be a little shocked. When I hang up, I'm going to look that up.
And the other element that I thought was perfect was the Boy Howdy symbol itself being done by Crumb. And to this day, you know, like I remember going to Detroit and seeing shows with like Negative Approach or Easy Action, John Brandon's other band.
Yeah.
And John's always sporting the Boy Howdy shirts, you know. It'll never go away. Those that don't know, and those that don't, well, whatever, you know, you need to explain to them. There was this magazine once called Cream.
Yeah, that's one of those logos where if you see someone wearing it, you kind of do this nod to each other. Like,
yeah, exactly. Like, yeah.
I got that. I got you. Yeah. And that's a really interesting story that we couldn't, there was some stuff there I couldn't get into with Crumb. And I think there's kind of a weirdness there a little bit. I can't get into it. But again, what a perfect guy to, or personality to be a part of the Boy Howdy story, right? The Cream story was our Crumb.
Sure.
Part of the counterculture that Cream was a part of.
It's always ironic as well that Crumb was not a fan of any of that kind of stuff. No. He'd rather be listening to, you know, old country blues records from the 20s. And yet that iconic image that he created for something which is, you know, one of the most renowned and respected parts of the counterculture in a way, you know?
Absolutely. I don't think he owns anything that's not at 78 RPM.
Yeah. I believe it. Yeah.
And he hates that stuff. But yeah, he needed the money and he just scribbled it out and boom. And then it became this... you know, and no one really fully knows what the hell it means. And I kind of like that too. Like you'd ask 20 different people and you'd get 20 different answers.
It was a boys magazine. It was meant for teenage boys. Did girls read it? Sure they did. It was only sexually provocative when it was funny. Was it offensive? Always. Those captions, was I offended? I wrote probably half of all those captions. Am I proud of that? It was the 70s. I mean, they weren't the same filters there are now. I mean, kill me.
Here's a question that might be a little difficult to answer. And I'm just wondering, do you see anything today in media that really has that kind of vibrancy or anything like on the net in terms of like music sites or even magazines in general or even podcasts that have that kind of the vibrancy or the spontaneity that you saw in Korean magazine?
I think probably podcasts might have the best chance to capture some of that just because right. It's so immediate. It's so spontaneous and you're in there and you're, but in terms of websites, you know, I don't want to sound completely uninformed, but I don't read that many. I have my music sites that I read just for my daily news or whatever. I don't feel any of that sense of urgency or any of the stuff that Cream captured or even the writing. I mean, it's the editing is so sloppy in so many websites that I see. It makes me crazy. But, you know, Pitchfork is obviously does really well for themselves. And I think they have pretty high editorial standards. I don't agree with a lot of it, but that's the point.
Who does?
So. But even like today, like comedy, like for example, Bernie, I was thinking of The Best Show.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And WFMU. Yeah. What he's done to me is kind of the equivalent in terms of comedy, in terms of just that feel.
That's a great example. Yeah. I think that's where you're going to find that kind of attitude and that kind of smarts. I don't see it happening in certainly not in a magazine format.
Print media is almost a thing of the past now, isn't it?
Yeah. And I'm someone that it took a long time for me to say that. You know, I would fight you. You know,
same.
For years, I would fight you on that and not anymore. I just, you know, it's.
I'd still rather, you know, read a magazine. About this kind of stuff, though. Like, you know, Mike McGonagall's Maggot Brain that he's putting out.
Oh, yeah, Maggot Brain's coming back. Yep.
Yeah, fantastic.
Motor Booty.
One of my favorites. Anything McGonagall does is good.
Yeah, he's great.
I just picked up Maggot Brain a couple months ago. I picked that up. And
Henry Owen did Chunklet.
I mean, Motor Booty was probably the closest in terms of like a capture. I mean, well, they're from Detroit, but that Cream spirit.
Right. What was it? The Beastie Boys did Grand Royal for a while.
That was good. Grand Royal, I thought, did a really good job of that too. Raygun sort of captured some of that stuff in the 90s.
Your Flesh as well. I think that had a sort of Detroit connection.
Yeah.
And that was a good one. David B. Livingstone, I think, was a Detroit guy.
Peter Davis published Your Flesh. That was a great one.
Yeah.
Peter, Your Flesh is fantastic.
Forced Exposure, of course.
And you know what? This is going to sound weird to some people, but I mean, I think some people do understand that. I love the smell of books.
Oh, me too.
Of course,
And the tangible, like all the tangible, just holding something tangible.
Yeah, I did magazines for years and I loved going and doing a press check because I could smell the paper.
Yeah.
God, I sound old, but the magazines would get delivered by a truck and it's just that tactile. There's a very...
That's exactly it. It's not just going in your eyes, you know, it's the whole physicality of it.
Yeah.
The smell of the ink and
There's a relationship that you develop. I know it sounds odd. It's no different than holding, you know, reading a book. It's the same thing. I'd much rather read a book. Than
exactly.
Or the same argument that we as music fans make about physical media in general.
You know,
your records or CDs or whatever rather than stream.
Right? We've been all debating about this stuff for years, right? Like with LPs and CDs, we were like, fuck CDs. Like you want to have like an LP where you can like...
Posters, stickers.
You want to feel that vinyl, you know, all that. So no, I'm still very much a part. I mean, I still... cling to that stuff, but I also know that that's not, you know, in terms of, I wouldn't ever, like, if someone were to ask me, hey, you want to launch a magazine? I would say, are you crazy?
But that's experience speaking, isn't it, at this point? So
unfortunately, yeah. I mean, I made a living, and I made a nice living for almost 10 years doing one. And then it was like 2008, 2009. It's just like, boom, it's just like, yeah. Vibe, me, a bunch of other magazines. We all, within a matter of 6 months, it's just like off a cliff. It's still sad to me now to go to a newsstand and see, I mean, there used to be aisle after aisle of magazines at some of the bigger brick and mortar stores. And now you're lucky if there's one.
You can strike a balance between approaching music as politics or approaching music without being able to separate it from politics.
You can't.
Which
you
is
can't separate well, it, though. But see, the thing is, like, if you separate it, I mean, what's the point? Because if you separate it, what value does it have? It's just another piece of music. It ain't no better or worse. Separated from its context, though, and its context is decidedly, if not political, sociological.
I wanted to come back to just a couple of questions in relation to the film itself. There's a little bit of footage that you have in the film, black and white footage that was shot in the offices of Cream, and there's even something that looks like an ad, a TV ad. Where did you get that footage? Was that just 8mm footage that the guys shot for their own enjoyment? Was that done for some local cable TV show? What was it all about? Where did you get that footage?
A little of both. Both. The stuff with Barry later on in the movie, when he's, you know, his health is, we're trying to kind of visually show just his decline physically too. You can see it in his face where he's sort of lost weight and he's just not there, versus the stuff that opens the film. It's just kind of a cold open with, you know, them in the newsroom, and then you're getting this guided tour of the offices. I'm not sure if the film would have succeeded in the same way that it did if we didn't have that footage, because it was so important to me to be able to show just what it was like to work there. And I mean, you can almost smell it, you know what I mean? And when I saw that footage, I got that really early on. That was done by a local PBS affiliate in Detroit. And it was about 20 minutes worth. And when I saw that, I said, okay, we've got a movie. Because how do you make a film? You know, there's so many people in the beginning when I said, no, I want to make a film about Cream. I'm doing a doc on Cream. And it's like, first of all, how do you make a documentary on a magazine? Well, I already had it in my head. So I was like, don't worry about it. I got this. But then when I saw that footage, I just went, okay, now I can show you, you know, in this way where you can experience it in a way where it's not just talking heads. The place was filthy. Well, now you can see how filthy it was.
Right. It's kind of like almost like Das Boot, where you're on the submarine. Right. You know, you're right in it.
It's claustrophobic. And
yeah.
Like you can, like I said, you can almost smell it. It's just, we were really lucky to have that footage. That, like I said, that footage to me really makes the film work.
One thing I was going to ask too is, well, first off, I wanted to say thank you for including, man, to me, one of the greatest songs ever written, singles of all time, City Slang.
I wanted to include, and I look at the list of stuff. If you see the original cut and you see all the music that was in there, it kills me too.
How hard was it for you to clear a lot of stuff? I mean, obviously for Wayne, it wouldn't have been a big issue, but I mean, it's just, I wonder how hard was it for you to try to get some stuff for the music, for the film?
It wasn't, a lot of it was not easy. There was stuff in there that I just couldn't get. And even the MC5 stuff was difficult.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, Wayne Kramer wrote the score for the film.
Right.
So we were lucky in that regard. There were only certain MC5 songs that we were able to use. So yeah, it was difficult and not cheap, you know, just to have an Iggy song in there. But you can't make a film about Detroit and about Cream and not have an Iggy Pop, you know, Stooges. So it had to be in there.
Exactly.
I love how you set the film up over the opening credits with 1969 as the opening song. It's perfect. It's like, boom, the moment the film starts, you know what you're in for.
Right.
It's absolutely perfect.
All right. It's 1969, okay. Walk across the USA. It's another year for me and you. Another year with nothing to do.
Thank you. Thank you. All of that came together. I want to say it came together easily. It didn't. But when you watch it now, you go, of course, like you would choose that song and do this. But I love that intro. I was really happy with it.
There's like people like JJ Kramer, the son of Barry and Connie, as well as Connie herself, who are involved as producers or executive producers. And Jan Ruzelski, who's working as your co-writer for the film, who was a senior editor at Cream. So did they approach you to say, we want to make this documentary about Cream, or?
I actually approached them. I had worked, Jan was my senior editor for 6 years when I was doing a magazine. So I knew Jan very well, and we, of course, stayed in touch. And when I was done with Salad Days and I was wrapping all that up, I had actually already started working on an outline for Cream while Salad Days was still like in theaters. I reached out to Jan, connected me with JJ, and a number of other filmmakers had approached him, and I kind of told him my outline and kind of my vision for how I saw the story being told, and we just immediately hit it off, and that was the story that I think he wanted to focus on. And but it meant a lot to me. I mean, I didn't take it lightly. I said, what's off limits in this film, because we need to get that out of the way, you know, now. And he, to his credit, he said nothing, because I wanted to tell a warts and all story.
Because I
knew enough. I'd worked with enough of the writers over the years that I knew a lot of that stuff already. And I said, well, it's the only way you can tell it. It was in that sort of very truthful, honest way.
It's kind of hard when you're sitting there listening to JJ talk about his dad.
It was tough. A lot of those things were really tough for him to shoot. There were several months worth of shoots that we had to do. It was tough. It was tough. I don't know how he did it. I don't know if I would have been able to do it.
Well, I mean, he grew up tough, I guess. You know, 4 years old and he was the chairman of the board.
So. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
One story I'd like, if you could please recount for our listeners who may not have seen the film yet, and it absolutely had me pissing myself with laughter, and I'm sure you already know which one it is, but it involves Dave Marsh, Lester Bangs, and a dog.
Oh, yeah. As I said, I had heard a lot of the stories through the years, and that was one story that I had known about and couldn't wait to tell. And it took us about, about 2 years to get Dave Marsh on board for the film. And I was like, I can't tell that story without getting Dave Marsh's reaction. But basically, Dave and Lester were the two big, well, there's a lot of big personalities in that magazine and that newsroom, but they were two of the biggest. And Dave is, you know, a type A kind of guy, and Lester's like a complete train wreck, hot mess, and was a total slob and was always making a mess. And Lester had a dog and Dave had a dog, and Lester's dog just shit all over the place. And one day Dave just got tired of it, and he picked up Lester's dog's pile of shit and he put it right on Lester's typewriter. Lester walks into the room, knows immediately who put the dog shit on his typewriter, and then he Dave wakes up and he comes down, because at that point they were all living in a house together, and the fight started in the offices, went all the way out into the driveway. You know, I think Dave got smacked. I mean, Lester's a big dude and Dave's like maybe 5'5", 5'6". Yeah, so it got very physical.
I love that bit where Dave says, well, he wasn't trying to kill me. He was just hitting my head with the car door.
Exactly. I love that. No, that was great.
Yeah. The other great Lester bit in the film is when you get the interview with Pete Wolf, when he's talking about how him and Lester having the argument about reviewing and music. And then Pete says, well, then bring it to the stage, man. So then, you know, how he winds up on stage with a typewriter and trashes, does the Pete Townsend and trashes.
Yeah. That was like the most, that's such a great story. I mean, how would that ever happen now? I can't even imagine who would do that now. But yeah, but again, that goes back to the celebrity thing too. I think Lester loved that. Taking a typewriter and throwing it into the, I mean, that's about as rock and roll as you can get. You know?
Yeah. I can't see somebody today doing it with a laptop sitting there on a stage, you know, with like an EDM concert with a little laptop typing away and just throwing their laptop on the floor.
Couldn't happen.
No.
I know that here in Melbourne, and I'm sure in many other cities around the world, we have big writers' festivals. My sister often goes to them. I'm going to say to her, hey, can you suggest that at the next writers' festival that you're allowed to go to post-COVID, that someone does something really punk rock, like throwing their laptop out into the audience?
Love that idea.
One one final question that I've got in relation to the, well, there's more to do with the magazine. I don't think he actually told this in the film, but I found an article at a music forum that Lester Bangs had written about Exile on Main Street. And so he was, you know, famously known for having completely destroyed the album and then came out later and said, I was wrong. I mean, look, I read the article and it wasn't actually a complete destroyal of the album. It was more like, you know, side one and side four are pretty great. Side two and side three have got a lot to answer for. But I think his contention seemed to be that we expect brilliance from the Stones and this is merely just good. How controversial was that article, the original article, before he recounted it later on?
I'm not sure. I don't know. It's not really talked about as much. Usually you hear more about, you know, the stuff he said about the Lou Reed or the Velvet Underground, stuff like that. But certainly, yeah, I'm sure there were tons of letters to the editor on that one. And, you know, that wasn't the first time that he would
backpedal.
Backpedal. Thank you. He did the same thing with MC5. You know, he destroyed MC5's first record. Yep. He actually destroyed that review, actually was in Rolling Stone, not Cream, where he just destroyed their debut album. And then, of course, you know, a year later, he moves to Detroit and him and Wayne are best friends. And it's a big love fest. So
artists tend to really have a good sense of humor about what came out of Cream. I mean, it would seem so. Some of the photos that you show, that they'd be posing for things with, you know, maybe non-flattering bylines about them.
Well, when you talk about posing, it actually got me to remember something that I remember exactly from Cream. I know you wouldn't know this, Morris, but there was actually every issue had a famous celebrity, like a musician, holding the bottle. And it would just have a questionnaire to have the name of the person and then them holding the bottle, like in a certain provocative pose, the Boy Howdy bottle, right? And then it would just be like kind of a bio. But that was a definitive part of every issue of Cream, was that somebody in a funny pose, because I remember Lemmy from Motorhead doing one, and I think Debbie Harry doing one, and but it was just
Wendy O. Williams.
Well, that was for a cheesecake thing. That was a little different.
Cream Dream, I believe.
Right.
What it's called. But yeah, the Boy Howdy can with the beer. I have to admit, when I found out years later that was just a label they put on, I was so pissed off. You know, I had someone in the movie, you know, I think Scott, one of the writers, actually says, you know, that was like, there is no Santa Claus.
Pretty much.
I was convinced it was like a beer you could buy in 7-Eleven.
Well, that's as bad as the Stooges Wax Museum.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yep.
That was Motor Booty, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. They said, Morris, they started a rumor that there was a Stooges Wax Museum just outside of Detroit, and, you
people
know.
Put up. People went looking for it and stuff. Yeah. And of course, it didn't exist. Yeah. They were really good at branding. More so than any other magazine, because now here it is, we're still talking about it, and Cream now no longer exists as a magazine, but as a brand. You know, it's up there with people wear like Black Flag or Sex Pistols t-shirts, even if they've never heard the band. It's kind of like Cream, like the Cream logo.
Right.
I'm sure most people that wear a Cream t-shirt know about Cream, but I'm sure there are plenty of others. I mean, John Varvatos is probably selling it for $200 in his store or something. Yeah.
So is that the antithesis of what Barry Kramer would have hoped for in the original days of Cream?
I think he was the brains behind that and knew how important branding was. And so he would have loved it. Even see there in the film, I don't want to give it away, but at a certain point in the film, you can see where he turns Dave Marsh around and Dave's wearing a Cream t-shirt. And he said, you know, someday this shirt's going to be a collector's item. Barry was always thinking big and was always thinking dollar signs, you know.
Right. I'm really surprised that Cream never went into their own kind of concert events.
There's so much they could, you know, and I think JJ is doing an amazing job now with Cream and the brand now. And I would not be surprised to see that kind of thing. I know nothing.
But I'm saying back in the day,
see him. He's smart enough and he's got a great team with him right now. And I think they could branch out into so many different things. So I wouldn't be shocked if you see that.
The film now, I mean, obviously, you know, we're saying at the beginning because of COVID and things have changed, but did it get a chance to show like on any film festival circuits or in the theater?
Oh, yeah, for sure. It premiered at South by Southwest, and then it did a number of film. I mean, we did a ton of film festivals, so it was great to really see it, you know, with an audience and to experience it. We premiered it in Detroit at the Free Film Festival in Detroit, and there were over 1,000 people there. It's a huge theater, and that was huge. And to see it with the hometown crowd, you know, it was kind of like when Sal Days played in D.C. to the hometown crowd. It was really important to me. It's kind of the most nerve-wracking. Like, are you going to get it right if the hometown crowd is like, oh man, digging it, then that's kind of a barometer of like what the rest of the world's going to think about it.
Didn't you use the Dirt Bombs Or was it, what am I thinking of? Did I hear the Dirt Bombs in the soundtrack?
Not the Dirt Bombs, but...
Or Danny's other band? Was it the Doll Rods? No? The Gorries.
The Gorries, thank you.
Yeah, it was the Gorries then. Yeah, I thought I heard something, and I was just like, wait a minute, man, I know what that is. Yeah.
All the music, and everyone just let me do it. Like, I was like, no, I got this. So I chose all the music. And
sweet.
The Gorries, I was like, no, I got it. And the great thing about the Gorries is that, you know, that's a 10 or 20-year-old song maybe, but it sounds so much a part of, like,
right.
that it was, like, perfect. And they're from Detroit. And
right.
So, no, I had a lot of fun with that. There was a lot of great music in that film.
And what have you got lined up now?
Right now, I'm working on a documentary about a guy named Joe Keithley.
Oh, Joey. I know Uncle Joey.
Yeah. Okay. So Joe, otherwise known as Joey Shithead. Joey was in a still is in a band called DOA. Greatest punk rock bands of, you know, arguably over the last 4 years. There, you know, in the 80s, it was like DOA, Black Flag, Minor Threat, Dead Kennedys.
SNFU. Yep.
Yeah, and they're from Canada. And so Joey has actually, he's still in the band, still performing, still touring the world, but ran for a council member seat in his town of Burnaby, which is about a 300,000 population city. Yep. It's not a small town by any means, as a Green Party member, and won against all odds. So to me, it's just like great, like David and Goliath kind of thing. And just putting together his activism and his being very politically active and outspoken for the last 40 years and now putting it into practice as an actual politician, I thought would make for an interesting doc. So what we're doing is we're following him as he campaigns next year. We'll be shadowing him while he's campaigning, going door to door, trying to get votes and try to win re-election, and win or lose, that'll be the film.
I know everybody says this every other second, man, but Joey's one of the nicest guys you will ever meet your entire life. I mean, that guy is so down to earth. It's not even funny. You know, every time I saw DOA come in and play, they'd unload the van. He'd be the first one pulling out the cabinets and everything. And we'd go out and help him. And hey guys, how you doing? Hey Joe, what's up, man? Like, just so down to earth.
Very down to earth. Their slogan was talk minus action equals zero. And that's really what the film is about. So I've been wanting to make like a more of a politically sort of minded film, and I thought this was the perfect way to do it. So it's really not so much a DOA film as it is more about this person that's been out there talking the talk, make real change.
What's interesting too is when he comes from his beginnings, and you know about the Squamish.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And about all that. Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting how you can go from the politics of extremism when you're younger and go through all that kind of caustic stuff and now winding up where he is now. That's really interesting. Yeah.
And that can never happen in America. So I think it's an interesting study of that as well. For those who don't know, well, first of all, the guy's name is Joey Shithead. In America, that just wouldn't fly, okay? But he's always been a radical lefty and remains that today. But he was also affiliated, you know, you mentioned the Squamish Five, you know, affiliated with a number of people that were very radical, like much more so than he was, to the point where they were imprisoned for various things that they did. So here he is 40 years later. He's like this icon in Canada. He's like this, you know, cult figure. So I'm really looking forward to doing a story where it's taking place right now, as opposed to, I mean, there'll be some of the film where obviously for context, where you have to look back and explain who this person is and why you're watching this film. But the rest of it's going to be, you know, in real time watching it unfold.
You know, what's really funny, Morris, Bernie, is like for the equivalent in Canada, a lot of people, it's like basically our Canadian Woody Guthrie, same attitude, the same kind of ideals.
Yeah, if you said that to him, he would be, I'm sure you'd make his day. But he even played with Pete Seeger. You know, in the 80s, they shared the protest show together. So, yeah, so there's a lot of great people in the film. You can check out the trailer if you want. If you do, there's a Facebook page for it. The name of the film is called Something Better Change. If you go on Facebook, you can see it. And the trailer is on there. The film's going to have everyone from Duff McKagan, Jello Biafra, Beto O'Rourke, who's a popular liberal Democrat here in America, is in the film. Ian MacKay, Henry Rollins, Keith Morris, you know, a lot of the familiar faces. But as I said, they'll help tell that early part of the story. And then the rest of the film will really be, I'll be literally shadowing him.
I'm not exactly sure, but I think they redid Fucked Up Ronnie with Fucked Up Donnie.
They did.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Fucked Up Ronnie was a song about Ronald Reagan in the 80s.
Right.
It was kind of, you know, one of their popular songs.
You're fucked up, Donald. You're not gonna last. Yes, they go on. You're talking in the ass.
Dipshit Donald Trump took over in America, 2016, they changed the song and changed the lyrics to Fucked Up Donnie. They've always had a good sense of humor, as well as being very serious politically.
A huge thanks to you, Scott, for taking the time. Zoom Connection even came up with a message saying, we're giving you a gift. You can talk beyond 40 minutes.
Yeah, they know a good thing.
Indeed, they do. I learned a lot from watching this documentary. Thank you so much for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, man.
Absolutely. I had a blast, and thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. Take care, everyone.
Thanks, Scott. We do appreciate it. Thanks a lot, man.
Yes. Got it, man. Anytime.
We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to episode 87 of See Here Podcast. And we're back. Our huge gratitude to Scott Crawford for taking the time and for making such a really wonderful documentary. It's available on the streaming platforms out there. We'll put in the show notes exactly where it is that you can see that, and it's really well worth your time. It's very tight, only 75 minutes, has everything you need to know about Cream, and there's plenty in there. So next month, it's Bernie's pick.
Despite what we were talking about 10 minutes ago, I do have a choice.
Okay, good.
So we are going to do a film from 1984, directed by one Alan Rudolph.
Oh, yeah.
Starring Willie Nelson and Kris Kristofferson, and it is called Songwriter.
Excellent. I watched this while we were prepping for Outlaw Blues.
Good. Well, I haven't watched it yet. It'd be a first time watch for me, so this should be interesting then.
Spoiler alert, you're in for a treat.
Oh, I do. I'm a big Alan Rudolph fan, so...
He's done a number of music-related projects as well.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, it should be fun.
All right, excellent. Some country music sounds and some very black humour coming at your ear holes for next month's episode of See Here. If you want to get in contact with us, email us at seeherepodcast@gmail.com. You can join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/seeherepodcast.
Follow us on Instagram at seeherepodcast.
And that is pretty much it. So until next month, read some good rock journalism, something that might rile you up, probably Pitchfork. Have some fun with it. Be nice. Listen to some great podcasts and listen to anything in the Pantheon Network. Just generally be nice to each other. All the best. Cheers.
Cheers.
Bye-bye. Little girl that I could not astound. But now we're talking about high class, baby. Woo-hoo-hoo! That's like the south of France. Woo-hoo-hoo! All the girls in your neighborhood are hoping I can spare a glance. Hear me knocking on those
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.